Hello, everybody. My name is Ross Smith. I work here at the college in the advancement office. And on behalf of all of my colleagues in advancement, I want to thank you all of you who provide support for the college, because your support provides the college the opportunity to bring faculty such as Professor Gallagher here to the campus and also keep them here, more importantly. So thank you all. With that, I get to the wonderful honor of introducing Professor Gallagher. Professor Gallagher joined the Connecticut College faculty in 1978, so we have done a good job of keeping him here. And he was awarded in 2002 the John S. King Faculty Award for Excellence in Teaching. And in 2006, he was given the Helen B. Reagan Faculty Leadership Award. His courses have included Understanding Global Religion, Cults, and Conversion in Modern America, and Holy Books, Scripture in Western Tradition. Professor Gallagher holds a BA from LaSalle University and an MA and PhD from the University of Chicago. And much like that, you know, that group REM and The End of the World and all that, you know, he's a rock star. So without further ado, I introduce Professor Gallagher to speak.
Thanks for coming. I think maybe the first thing I should say is, if you see somebody that you haven't gotten to say hello to yet, just look and make sure. I'll make sure to leave enough time afterwards so that you can reconnect and all of that. I always am really deeply struck with appreciation when people actually come back to their alma mater. I have strong ties to my undergraduate alma mater. And when I go back, I really see what stayed the same and what really was great for me, and also some things that changed. And so I imagine you'll see that. I guess the other thing that happens at reunion is, you know, say, well, boy, I didn't think I was out of school for fill in the blank number of years. And as Ross just said, I wasn't really remembering that I'm about to start my 35th year. Next year will be my 35th reunion at Connecticut College. So having started at 12, I've seen a lot of changes here at the college, and hope to see more in my next 35 years while I'm here. I'm also impressed when people who are at a reunion take time out from having fun and reconnecting with friends and stealing the golf carts and things like that. Not a great day for that today, but I highly recommend it if the sun's out tomorrow. To come to something like this, I was asked to give a lecture. I confess that I hate to give lectures. I want to hear from you as much as you want to hear from me, maybe more. And I'm going to try to incorporate what you have to say and what you think into what we do here. So I'll start. I've got this title, 2012 and Beyond, The End of the World, which was not foisted on me by the college advancement people to add urgency to their appeals to you. Though, Greg, we might want to talk about that as we come towards the date that we're anticipating. So at least since I was in graduate school, when dinosaurs walked the earth and I did my dissertation on an electric typewriter, and always kept a copy in the refrigerator in case fire would strike. I kid you not, we all did that. You had to have, never mind, okay. It was a scary time. I've ended up studying a number of groups, first in the ancient Mediterranean world, let's say a couple hundred years either side of zero, and then more recently in the contemporary U.S., who were thinking about the end of the world in one way or another. I've had the great good fortune every once in a while to offer a course and to sneak past the registrar's office a title like The End of the World, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 o'clock. We have to be right on one of those Tuesdays or Thursdays. The other cool thing, I don't know if they've talked to you much about this, one thing that was really wonderful that happened at the college in April was that we had a TED conference. Has anybody heard of those TED talks and TED conferences? Well, we had TEDx. It didn't mean that the talks were all X-rated. It did mean that a bunch of students at the college got together and appealed to the TED people for a license to have a TEDx conference here. They're going to try to keep doing it. It was really pretty spectacular. Evans Hall was just about filled up mid-April.
Who
knows TED? Who's a friend of TED? Technology Education Development, I think.
Yes.
All right, and they typically had all kinds of silicon. What is it?
Design,
right. They had all kinds of Silicon Valley people, so Steve Jobs would give a TED Talk and all kinds of things like that. They became so popular that they're kind of now a franchise, and you're supposed to give the talk of your life in 18 minutes. I hope I failed, because I hope, you know, that's not the end, but I hope it was okay. But it was spectacular that our student body put it together and got that franchise license. I think it was one of the things that's very distinctive about Conn this year and the things we've been able to offer. So I got to talk about that there a little bit. What have you heard about 2012 and the end of the world? Has anybody heard anything?
Coming December 12th.
Warm.
Something like that.
Dyslexically warm.
Sorry.
21st. All right. Right. Well, then there's all kinds of stuff. Some people say 23rd. Some people say 21st. And then what else was there? Anybody confess to having seen the movie? I'll confess. For me, it was research. You know, I had to go and see the movie. So there's been a number of things in the popular press largely hinging on the so-called Mayan long count calendar that comes really like the odometer on a car comes to 13.0.0.0.0. I think that's enough zeros. You get the idea. As far as most folks can tell, 21st of December 2012. So the question has been then, what's the big deal about that? Is that going to tell us something? What were the Mayans thinking about? Were they thinking, you know, we got to get some stuff done here because we're going to run out of time at some point? Or were they saying, well, it might be time to trade this in when the odometer ticks over to that set of zeros? What does it mean? There's been a whole lot of speculation about what it means. If you go to something like YouTube or just Google 2012 Mayan calendar, something like that, you can pretty much spend another couple years reading everything that you find. What I want to do a little bit is pick up on that general, public, popular interest in the Mayan calendar and talk a little bit about how I would propose that we understand this phenomenon of expecting the end of the world. Does anybody know if that's the first time somebody has predicted the end of the world? Oh, come on, you know, that's too easy a question. All right, when else has the world been predicted to end? Yes, sir. Nostradamus, and especially if you do your own shopping and you spend enough time in line, he shows up periodically in those various magazines as predicting all kinds of stuff. What else? Anybody else?
Heaven's Gate, the rapture.
Heaven's Gate. There's a person from the San Diego area.
From the exact town.
From the exact town. I wasn't going to implicate you too much in that. A group in, what was it?
Rancho Santa Fe.
Yeah, it was 94?
Five.
Maybe. Four, five, six, somewhere around late, mid to late 90s. that saw the arrival of the Hale-Bopp comet as signaling some huge transformation. Sadly, unfortunately, ended up taking their own lives, about 30-some of them, in the hope that they would make a transition beyond that. I had actually been away with my daughter last week visiting some Mayan sites, and we didn't get enough timing on the sound effects for when they were precisely needed. That's one example. As a matter of fact, when I get to teach this stuff in class, I usually tell my students, if they give me enough time, I will find any decade in the last 2,300 years or so. And if they really give me enough time, I'll find any year in the last 2,300 years or so when somebody, somewhere, thought the world was going to end. So this has been a preoccupation, certainly in Western history, and specifically in Western religious history. And so then this speculation about 2012 and the Mayan calendar needs to be nestled into that context for some further understanding of it. Some other stuff to set the stage. I'm not making any of this up. Usually, you know, good 55 minutes of a 75-minute class I'm making up, but this stuff I'm not making up. Polling data released in 2010, just a couple years ago, indicates the following. This is from the Pew Research Center, so they're pretty reputable, these folks. Fully 58% of white evangelical Christians expect Jesus to return to earth and initiate the ends, events of the end within the next 40 years. So that's by 2050. Let me say that again. Fully 58%. About a third of Catholics agree, along with a little more than a quarter of white mainline Protestants. Now here's where you can congratulate yourselves probably. Slightly fewer than a fifth of college graduates hold the same expectation, while nearly 60% of those with no college experience endorse it. Another potential selling point for a liberal arts degree. More than half the respondents in the South expect a second coming by 2050. As those numbers suggest, the expectation of a second coming of Jesus is deeply ingrained in Christian and American culture. Not only is that the only kind of millennialism that we see in American culture, there are all kinds of other variants that are not directly tied to Christian, Jewish, or Muslim expectations. Timothy McVeigh, for example. Anybody remember Timothy McVeigh? See, that's why I like talking to alumni. You can remember some stuff. He espoused a form of millennialism that was almost entirely disconnected from the religious roots in the Western tradition. It was tinged with religion nonetheless. For example, he wrote in a letter to a friend of his in July 1994, less than a year before the bombing of the Mora building in Oklahoma City that killed 168 people. McVeigh wrote, "I know in my heart that I am right in my struggle, Steve." This is the guy he's writing to. "I've come to peace with myself, my God, and my cause. Blood will flow in the streets, Steve. Good versus evil, free men versus socialist wannabe slaves. Pray that it is not your blood, my friend." A variety of conspiracy theories, often including beliefs about a dawning, malevolent new world order. Back in the day, Reverend Pat Robertson wrote a book called The New World Order. George Bush the First talked periodically about the New World Order. But then a lot of people have taken that up and seen this as a kind of malevolent end to the world as we know it. And then they also frequently include speculations about things like aliens being involved in the end of the world. And one of my favorites, reptilian creatures who live within the earth, coming up and taking over and ending the world as we know it. My friend Mike Barkin, who works at Syracuse University, calls this improvisational millennialism. Millennialists in general are so hungry for meaning that they can take almost anything and incorporate it into a system. So we want to figure out how this stuff should be understood if, for example, it's such a persistent factor in American culture and history, and it has been historically happening, I'm going to say it, every year. Yeah. So if you ask folks like the so-called new atheists, Christopher Hitchens, who's now dead, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and Richard Dawkins, who all wrote books against religion in the mid-2000s, they'd likely say, here we see again how nutty religious people are, and that they have counterproductive fantasies that are promising them things that they will never get. But to the believers who espouse the views that the second coming or its millennial equivalent is going to happen soon within their lifetime, what does this represent? How do we understand it? They are after, as Ross alluded to in the beginning, the change of the world as we know it. They are after the end of the world as we know it, and I forget what class you have to be in here, probably in the 90s. What's the refrain from REM?
I feel fine.
And I feel fine. Why would somebody want to feel fine? It, well, 92 or 97?
87.
Oh, is it that old?
Yeah.
I've been here too long. Yeah. All
right. No, it was 92 the song.
92 song, okay. No, so it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. So that's got the crux of the matter there. How can somebody feel fine that it is the end of the world as we know it? I was tempted just to take that and take that phrase apart for about 45 minutes, but then I decided not to. Okay. So what are we dealing with? I've used the term a couple times already. We're dealing with what scholars often call millennialism. Does anyone know where that term comes from? Actually, told you I didn't want to give a speech.
Oh, great guess.
Yes.
Because when the millennium turned, everybody, a lot of people thought the world was going to end. Planes mm-hmm. were going to fall out of the sky. I shouldn't say the world would end, but all these terrible things were going to happen. Nothing happened.
I am forever captured on YouTube saying, in the short first version of it, the shit will hit the fan. Okay, which is the end of the world as we know it. Anybody else got it? What was the millennium?
Well, to us it was 2000.
Well, that was the term. It's 1,000 years. It's 1,000-year period. And the term actually comes from the Latin translation of the biblical book of Revelation. In the Christian collection of scriptures, in chapter 20, verse 4 of the book of Revelation, it mentions 1,000-year period in which the saints will reign. And the saints, of course, are the people who sing the refrain, "And I feel fine." It doesn't say that the people who are thrown into the fiery pit of hell will be singing, "I feel fine." And as a matter of fact, a lot of millennialist texts anticipate with maybe even excessive glee what will happen to the people who are not the people who are feeling fine, and describe it in loving detail. So the term mille in Latin is 1,000. If you really start to read this stuff, sometimes you see it called kiliasm from people who get fancy and use the Greek term for 1,000. But it refers to this 1,000-year period in which everything will be fine. It gets more complicated after that. Okay. So in general, millennialism can be understood as the conviction that the end of the world as we know it is imminent. It's coming real soon. Collective, it's going to happen to a whole lot of people, if not everyone on Earth. Terrestrial, it's going to play out here, not somewhere else. Total, and achieved by supernatural or at least extraordinary intervention. So that was a lot of big words. The way I would put it is millennialism charts a path between the world as it is and the world as it ought to be, and then tries to show how you can get from one to the other, the way the world is and the way the world ought to be. So millennialism typically comes in two forms: catastrophic and progressive. Catastrophic
is when the fan gets messed up. Okay. Fire and brimstone. The fiery pit of hell opens up in the book of Revelation. Monsters come out of the sea. Cosmic, natural, social, economic, religious turmoil happen with catastrophic millennialism. So if anybody would admit to having seen the movie 2012, besides me, what's happened? Asteroids are chasing poor John Cusack, right? Yeah, poor John can barely get on the plane before the whole runway disintegrates under him and the asteroids are coming down. That is catastrophic. Volcanoes are erupting. Woody Harrelson gets blown to bloody hell at one point. Yeah. And this stuff is not just the imagination of Ronald Emmerich and Hollywood producers. If you could film the film, that's my Philadelphia accent coming out. If you could film the chapter 13 of the Gospel according to Mark, it would have all of that stuff in it, except Woody Harrelson. He's somehow missing there. So catastrophic millennialism tends to take the position that this world is in such trouble that only extraordinary or even supernatural intervention can destroy it so that a new world can grow out of it. Also then from the biblical book of Revelation is this notion of a new heaven and a new earth. So millennialists are not always totally pessimistic. It's the end of the world as we know it, and we're going to feel fine when it's over. Okay. Is another part of that. And I'll get to some other examples of that as we go. Progressive millennialism is rather different. Progressive millennialism is through human effort, maybe with some divine aid, every day in every way we can make this a better world. Examples of progressive millennialists in the United States, U.S. history, the Theosophical Society in the late 19th century had a lot of interesting ideas, but was also very theologically engaged with social issues such as women's suffrage, trying to bring about gradually the perfected world in this world through human effort. Okay. They're a good example. The social gospel movement in the 20th century. Elements of the kind of religious feminist movement, religiously motivated civil rights movement in the United States will intersect with progressive millennial beliefs. But they don't get filmed by Hollywood. It's catastrophic millennialism that gets the attention. Catastrophic millennialism comes up with some of the 2012 people who pick up on the Mayan calendar and say that huge changes will happen. Don't buy Christmas presents, for example, because after the 21st of December 2012, things will be real different. I don't know if that means things will be on sale or precisely what conclusions to draw from that. So that's a little terminology that can help us start to make sense, I hope, of this. A little bit of history, too. I've mentioned some of the text in the Christian Bible. The first thing that Jesus says in the Gospel of Mark, which most scholars, 90-some percent scholars, think is the earliest historical gospel, comes from around the year 70. The first thing he gets to say in that one is, "The time is fulfilled. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the good news." Which has led people from Alfred Schweitzer on to portray the Jesus of the Gospels as a millennialist preacher, okay, looking for the arrival of the kingdom of God. 20 years earlier, in the early 50s, the Christian missionary named Paul wrote to a bunch of people in the Greek port city of Corinth, and he said in the same chapter, "The appointed time has grown short. The present form of this world
is passing away. He was especially interesting in invoking his millennialist beliefs to regulate sexual behavior. At one point he said, "It would be better if everybody were like me and had no sexual relations with anybody. If you're married, it's still better if you don't do anything about it. But if you're burning with lust, go ahead and get married if you have to." It was a very grudging admission. One of the simplest and most powerful evocations of the millennial transformation of our world comes at the beginning of chapter 21 of Revelation. This is where the seer named John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away." So this is not limited to the Christian tradition. The book of Daniel in the Hebrew Bible is probably the earliest full, pretty gung-ho millennialist or apocalyptic book in the Hebrew Bible. There's lots of stuff in Islam from the very beginning, a real preoccupation with the day that is coming, the day of judgment that is coming. There are other situations that have generated millennialist thinking, most notably probably the encounters of colonial power and native populations in the 19th and 20th century in Africa and the South Pacific. In the South Pacific, this gave rise to a group of movements that for a while were called cargo cults. Anybody a Men at Work fan? The second Men at Work album from an Australian pop rock band that was put out in the US was called Cargo, making fun of that whole idea. The idea in cargo cults came from this clash of one civilization that apparently by making weird little marks on a piece of paper in the next week, refrigerators full of food, trucks and all kinds of stuff would show up. And so this raised for the native population the issue of how come they have cargo and we have to work our butts off in the garden? And what could we do to get stuff like that? Which were some native millennial movements in that area. And we've started off with this Mayan long count calendar stuff. So what does all this stuff mean? Why are people so intent on imagining the end of the world as we know it? I think in some ways, millennialism expresses a yearning that things could be different. At the same time that it expresses a sense of powerless to affect that change. It says, things have gotten so bad that we need help. We need help from somebody other than ourselves. In its darker forms, conspiracy millennialist thinking, it's a fear that the world is becoming uncontrollably different and uncontrollably inimical. Millennialists are convinced that the world we live in is far from perfect and that it is badly in need of renovation. Interestingly, though, or at least I think so, right? Interestingly, millennialism is frequently ambivalent about what folks ought to do. One of my colleagues, Jeff Kaplan at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, great name, says waiting is what millennialists do best. They're often kind of standing there off to the side saying, things pretty bad, aren't they? Yeah. I said, I hope God's gonna straighten this stuff out. Yeah. What should we do? I guess wait. Although sometimes this comes with the urging to cultivate yourself in such a way that you can be among those who will be saved for the new world, be among those who will feel fine, rather among those who do not. So that is one take on waiting. Every once in a while, though, as with my brief example from Timothy McVeigh's correspondence, there's people that say, no, we need to get involved. We need to do something about this. Now, in catastrophic forms of millennialism, this can take the kind of form of violent action. So millennialists can sometimes turn violent. In progressive millennialism, it takes the form of these various social movements that we mentioned, women's suffrage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the actions that are urged upon those who endorse a catastrophic vision of the millennium can be located anywhere along a continuum from passive waiting to active involvement. Title of one of the scrolls found among the so-called Dead Sea Scrolls in the 1940s by the Dead Sea, appropriately enough, in Israel, is the War of the Sons of Light against the Sons of Darkness. They were getting ready to gear up the Sons of Light to make this new world come into being. But they're relatively rarer, I would think, the ones that demand dramatic action. So millennialism ends up being a malleable perspective. It's got this strong indictment of the world as we know it, this passionate yearning for a new world, but also it has this real ambivalence about what human beings ought to do. Should they just cultivate their personal character and piety so that they might be worthy of being taken into this new world? This is your Heaven's Gate example. You know, what do you have to do to be worthy of ascending to the evolutionary level above human, T-E-L-A-H, as they called it. All right. So virtually all forms of catastrophic millennialism involve this final sorting into, as one of the Gospels has it, sheep and goats. You want to be a sheep in this case. This is one of the cases where you want to be a sheep. For those who have assurance that they will indeed enter it, the world to come can represent a culmination of both history and their own efforts at self-cultivation. But millennialism is always exclusive also. For those who doubt that they'll enter the world to come or who are denied entry by others, it can scarcely represent an amelioration of their previous conditions and may actually represent an exacerbation of things. Not only am I screwed, but I'm damned forever. Progressive millennialism, this kind of somewhat minor strain, can be a powerful incentive to change the way the world currently is. But progressive millennialism also, and this is where it intersects with some of the 2012ers again, as in some forms of New Age teaching, can also lead individuals to focus entirely on the cultivation of their higher selves at the expense of any form of social engagement. My favorite example of this occurs in that great 20th century autobiography in multiple volumes, Shirley MacLaine's Out on a Limb. And at the end of Out on a Limb, which is volume one in this ongoing autobiographical project, a person with a lot of time on her hands, there's a conversation between the late Representative Bella Abzug from New York City and Shirley MacLaine, in which Bella is clearly getting driven nuts by Shirley, because says, well, why are you just working on yourself all the time? There's people who need food. There's people who need economic justice. There's people who need this and that. And the fight is really about whether this is a personal self-cultivation only, or whether there needs to be social engagement. And that is kind of one of the cleavages, I'd say, if you read more and more of the New Age appropriation of the Mayan stuff. The Mayan guy I talked to last week said, yeah, those people are nuts. He was not buying into the hype, even though he was a tour guide and it was getting him more business. But this issue that you see in the New Age appropriation of the 2012 calendar is, what does it mean? Does it mean that there will be mental changes, or does it mean that there will be social justice in some form or another, however it's conceived? Okay, so what's all this mean? Because you guys clearly want to have more fun and go on to the next thing. Millennialism is a persistent feature of American social and religious life. It weaves its way into our politics, our economics, social issues, not just in religious issues. One of the things I haven't talked about much, though, is the extraordinary popularity
of a set of novels entitled Left Behind. Has anybody encountered any of them? There are only 12 of them in the Fundamental series. They're all about 500 pages long. I read one once when I was stuck on a plane, and I got the 500 pages done in about 2 hours. So they're not really dense to read, but they're a dramatization of what will happen at the end of the world. It starts out with the grating but nonetheless authoritative airline captain Rayford Steele introduces later the journalist Buck Williams, among other cardboard characters, and the cabin attendant Hattie comes into the cabin as they're going across the Atlantic and says, "Captain, we're missing 40 passengers." And Captain Steele knows by page 7, I don't know why it takes 12 volumes then to play this whole thing out, but Captain Steele knows by page 7 that they have been raptured up into the heavens and that the end of the world is unfolding as he's flying across the Atlantic. Last time I checked, the 12 of them had sold more than 70 million copies. 70 million copies. This is not counting the prequels, the kids' version, or the movies. All right, any Growing Pains watchers? Kirk Cameron from Growing Pains has financed and starred in the movies because he's dropped out of entertainment to become a kind of evangelical Christian missionary. You got to have like one little fact that you get for showing up. You know? So the millennial vision can be as capacious as the current vague but widespread expectation about 21 December 2012, or it can be constricting like the specifics of the Book of Revelation or the Left Behind series. But millennialism, I think, as an object of our concern, forces some really important questions. Is this progress towards something? If so, what? For whom? Who's going to benefit and who's going to suffer? What should one do in order to enjoy the benefits of this progress? Ultimately, what drives the vision of a new heaven and a new earth? Human effort or divine intervention? Millennialism itself is socially, culturally, and religiously specific. It's not going away. It's going to continue to mark American life for as long as there is American life. The other question I think we need to ask is in its vivid, catastrophic, dualistic form. It always forces the question of, will someone always be left behind? That's it. Thank you. I don't remember when this is supposed to be over. I'm happy to have refutations, comments, questions, anything. Finish my big flagon of water. Yes, ma'am. Do you guys all have matching things?
Yes.
That's so cool. All right, so this is what really happens, like behind the scenes when people are teaching, you're wandering around saying, they all have the same scarves on. Then you're worried about whether it'll come out of your mouth. Yes. Anything that bears the influence of, let's say, Christianity, which is pretty much a lot of the world,
yes.
Anyway, is being driven by that millennial vision that's part of the Bible. You can't take it out.
Okay.
And one of the most interesting things, say, in Jerusalem these days is, on the one hand, there's a group of very dedicated, pious Jews who want to rebuild the third temple. But they want to rebuild it where there just happens to be the Dome of the Rock. Okay. There's an organization called the Temple Institute that is making all the implements, like the trumpets and the sacrificial stuff, for when the temple is there. And it has support not only from pretty, I would say, far right-wing Jewish features, but also from conservative American evangelicals who see the conversion of the Jews as part of the end times scenario.
So each of the guys is saying to the other, I'll take your support. I think you're full of shit ultimately, but I'm going to take your support while we're doing this. So it is really a global phenomenon, but I was just kind of focusing on this stuff in the U.S. Yeah. Yes, sir?
Are there strains of millennialism in Buddhism and Hinduism?
Yeah. Yeah. There's Buddhist millennialism, and I didn't want to kind of get into that. The Hindu stuff in the classic text is different because you've got this theory of the yugas, the four yugas, and we've been for a long time in the last of the four, and it's really a going downhill thing. We're in the Kali Yuga. Kali is this fearsome goddess with a belt of skulls and all kinds of stuff. And when that hits, it won't be the end, but it will be the start of a new enormous cycle. So that's related a little bit to the smarter appreciation of the Mayan stuff, because most Mayanologists now are pretty sure that the odometer turning over at 13.0.0.0.0 is just a renovation of the world at that point, not the end in this kind of classic Judeo-Christian Islamic view of the end. Yeah. Yes, sir?
So you mentioned that there's been potentially every single year in the past 2,300 years some version of millennium. Are there systematic changes in those versions of millennialism over time? Or does it pretty much manifest in the same way today as it did 1,000 or 2,000 years ago?
Well, certainly communication media now make spreading these messages a lot easier. Just, you know, if you want to Google reptilians, it'll blow your mind. The stuff you'll find there and on YouTube and all of that. What's pretty fascinating to me is how you can stack, let's say, commentaries on the book of Revelation from around the 3rd century after zero to the present. And each one has lots of similarities. I know what the seven seals are all about. My favorite one on this, some of you who had me in class in the 90s know this, I ended up writing a book about what happened in Waco. And the guy, David Karras, there said he was given to understand the seven seals, the scroll sealed with seven seals in the book of Revelation. All right, so that all goes south and he's dead and all that. But there arose a new prophet that said, and I understand the seven seals even better because he only read the front of the scroll. You can predict what I read the front and the back. So there's patterns of similarity and then this desperate thirst for originality that's there. So you see people kind of caught between these texts are authoritative and they really lay out for us what's going to happen, yet we need a new take on it for a new time. So it's kind of constantly refreshing itself, though if you wanted to do a millennialist vocabulary book, you wouldn't have to add a whole lot of new terms all the time. There's a great book by Norman Cohn called The Pursuit of the Millennium in the Medieval Period, where you see some of the same stuff in medieval Europe. What do you think, Ross? Time to throw me out?
I told you he was a rock star, did I not?
Thank you, Professor.